Nahoot saw one of the monks hit in the forehead. His skull erupted in a cloud of blood and brain tissue, and the gunman who had shot him laughed as he fired. They were all caught up in the madness of the moment. Like a pack of wild dogs, they had run down their prey. They kept on firing and reloading and firing again. The monks in the front rows turned to flee and ran into those behind. They struggled together, howling with agony and terror, until the storm of bullets swept over them, killing and maiming, and they fell upon the heaps of dead and dying. The floor of the chamber was carpeted with the dead and the wounded. Trying to escape the hail of bullets, the monks blocked the doorway, plugging it tight with their struggling white-clad bodies, and now the troopers, standing clear in the centre of the quiddist, turned their guns upon this trapped mass of humanity. The bullets socked into them, and they heaved and tossed like trees of the forest in a gale of wind. Now there was very little screaming. The guns were the only voices that still clamoured. It was some minutes before the guns stuttered into silence, and then the only sound was the groans and the weeping of the wounded. The chamber was filled with a blue mist of gun smoke and the stink of burned powder. Even the laughter of the soldiers was silenced as they stared around them and realised the enormity of the slaughter. The entire floor was carpeted with bodies, their shamas splashed and speckled with gouts of scarlet, and the stone paving beneath them was awash with sheets of fresh blood in which the empty brass cartridge cases sparkled like jewels. "Cease firing!" Nogo gave the belated order. "Shoulder arms! Pick up the load! Forward march!" His voice roused them, and they slung their weapons and stooped to lift their heavy tapestry-wrapped burdens. Then they staggered forward, their boots squelching in the blood, tripping over the corpses, stepping on bodies that either convulsed or lay inert. Gagging in the stench of gun smoke and blood, of bowels and guts ripped wide open by the bullets, they crossed the chamber. When they reached the doorway and staggered down the steps into the deserted outer chamber of the church, Nahoot saw the relief on the faces of even these battle-hardened veterans as they escaped from the reeking charnel house. For Nahoot it was too much. Never in his worst nightmares had he seen sights such as these. He tottered to the side wall of the chamber and clung to one of the woollen hangings for support. Then, heaving and retching, he brought up a mouthful of bitter bile. When he looked around him again, he was alone, except for a wounded monk who was dragging himself across the flags towards him, his spine shot through and his paralysed legs slithering behind him, leaving a slimy snail's trail of blood across the stone floor. Nahoot screamed and backed away from the wounded monk, then whirled and fled from the church, along the cloisters above the gorge of the Nile, following the group of soldiers as they carried their burdens up the stone staircase. He was so wild with horror that he did not even hear the approach of the helicopter until it was hovering directly overhead on the glistening silver disc of its spinning rotor. Gotthold von Schiller stood outside the front door of the Quonset hut with Jutta Kemper waiting a pace behind him. The pilot had radioed ahead while the Jet Ranger was in flight, so all was in readiness to receive the precious cargo it was carrying. The helicopter raised a cloud of pale dust from the landing circle as it sank down to the earth. The long tapestry-covered load it carried had not been able to fit into the cabin and was strapped across the landing skids of the aircraft. The instant that the skids kissed the ground and the pilot cut back the throttle, Jake Helm led out a team of a dozen men to loosen the nylon retaining straps and lift the heavy bundle down. Between them, the gang of overall-clad workers carried the steeler to the hut and eased it through the door. Helm hovered close at hand, issuing terse orders. A space had been cleared in the centre of the conference room. The long table pushed back against the wall. With extreme care, the steely was laid there, and minutes later the coffin of Tanus, the great lion of Egypt, was laid beside it. Brusquely, Helm dismissed the gang and closed and bolted the door behind them as they left. Only the four of them remained in the room. Nahoot and Helm crouched beside the steely, ready to unwrap the woolen tapestry. Von Schiller stood at the head of it, with Jutta at his side. "Shall we begin?" Helm asked softly, watching Von Schiller's face the way a faithful dog watches its master. "Careful," Von Schiller warned him in strangled tones. "Do not damage anything." He was sweating in a sheen across his forehead, and his face was very pale. Jutta edged protectively closer to him, but he did not glance in her direction. He was staring fixedly at the treasure that lay at his feet. Helm opened his clasp knife and cut away the tasseled cords that secured the covering. As he watched, Von Schiller's breathing became louder. It rasped in his throat like a man in the terminal stages of emphysema. "Yes," he whispered hoarsely, "that's the way to do it." Jutta Kemper watched his face. He was always like this when he made another significant addition to his collection of antiquities. He seemed on the verge of a seizure, of a massive heart attack, but she knew he had the heart of an ox. Helm came to the top end of the pillar and carefully opened a small slit in the cloth. He eased the point of the blade into this opening and then ran it slowly down towards the base like a zip fastener. The blade was razor sharp, and the cloth fell away to reveal the inscribed stone beneath it. The sweat burst out like a heavy dew on Von Schiller's skin. It dripped from his chin onto the front of his khaki bush jacket. He made a small moaning sound as he saw the carved hieroglyphics. Jutta watched him, her own excitement mounting. She knew what to expect of him when he was caught up in this paroxysm of emotion. "See here, Herr von Schiller," Nahut knelt beside the obelisk and traced the outline of a broken-winged hawk with his finger. "This is the signature of the slave Taita." "Is it genuine?" Von Schiller's voice was that of a very sick man, wheezing and gusty. "It is genuine. I will guarantee it with my life." "It may come to that," Von Schiller warned him. His eyes were glittering with the hard brilliance of pale sapphires. "This column was carved nearly 4,000 years ago," Nahut repeated stoutly. "This is the veritable seal of the scribe." He translated glibly and easily from the blocks of figures, his face shining with an almost religious rapture. "Anubis, the jackal-headed, the god of the cemeteries, holds in his paws the blood and the viscera, the bones and the lungs and the heart that are my separate parts. He moves them like the stones of the baleboard. My limbs serve him as counters. My head is the great bull of the long board." "Enough," Von Schiller commanded. "There will be time for more later. Go now. Leave me alone. Do not return until I send for you." Nahut looked startled and scrambled to his feet uncertainly. He had not expected to be dismissed so abruptly in the moment of his triumph. Helm beckoned him, and the two of them went quickly to the door of the hut. "Helm," Von Schiller called thickly after him, "make certain that nobody disturbs me." "Of course, Herr Von Schiller," he glanced inquiringly at Jutta Kemper.
"No," said Von Schiller, "she stays."
The two men left the room, and Helm shut the door carefully behind them. Jutta crossed the room and turned the key. Then she faced Von Schiller with her hands behind her and her back pressed to the door. Her breasts were thrust forward, firm and pointed. The nipples showed clearly through the thin cotton blouse, hard as marbles.
"The costume?" she asked. "Do you want the costume?"
Her own voice was tight and strained. She enjoyed this game almost as much as he did.
"Yes, the costume," he whispered.
She crossed the room and disappeared through the door into his private quarters. As soon as she was gone, Von Schiller began to undress. When he stood mother naked in the centre of the room, he threw his clothing in a heap into one corner and turned to face the door through which she would return. Suddenly she stood in the doorway, and he gasped at the transformation. She wore the wig of tight Egyptian braids, and over it the uraeus, the golden circlet with the hooded cobra standing erect above her forehead. The crown was genuine, as old as the ages. Von Schiller had paid 5 million Deutschmarks for it.
"I am the reincarnation of the ancient Egyptian Queen Lostris," she purred. "My soul is immortal. My flesh is incorruptible."
She wore golden sandals from the tomb of a princess, and bracelets and finger rings and earrings from the same tomb. All were authentic royal relics.
Yes, his voice was choking, his face as pale as death. Nothing can destroy me. I will live forever, she said.
Her skirt was diaphanous yellow silk, belted with gold and precious stones.
Forever, he repeated.
She was naked above the waist. Her breasts were big and white as milk. She cupped them in her own hands.
These have been young and smooth for 4,000 years, she purred. I offer them to you.
She stepped out of the open golden sandals, and her feet were slim and neat. She parted the frontal split in the yellow skirts and held it so that her lower body was exposed. All her movements were slow and calculated. She was a clever actress.
This is a promise of eternal life.
She placed her right hand on her dense, honey-coloured pubic bush.
I offer it to you.
He groaned softly and blinked the streaming sweat out of his eyes, watching her avidly. She undulated her hips slowly and luridly as an uncoiling cobra. She moved her feet apart and opened her thighs. With her fingers she spread the lips of her vulva.
This is the gateway to eternity. I open it for you.
Von Schiller groaned aloud. No matter how often repeated, the ritual never failed. Like a man in a trance, he moved towards her. His body was thin, dried out like a 1,000-year-old mummy. His chest hair was a silver fuzz. The skin of his sunken belly was folded and wrinkled, but his pubic hair was dark and thick as the hair on his head. His penis was huge, out of all proportion to the skinny old frame from which it dangled. As she moved slowly to meet him, it filled out and hung at a different angle, and of its own accord the wizened foreskin peeled back to reveal the massive purple head behind it.
"On the stele," he grunted. "Quickly, on the stone."
She turned her back to him and knelt upon the stone, watching him over her shoulder as he came up behind her. Her buttocks were round and white as a pair of ostrich eggs. Helm and his men worked late that night in the Pegasus workshop, making the wooden crates to house both the stele and the coffin securely. At dawn the next day they were loaded onto one of the heavy trucks, cushioned with thick rubber matting, and strapped down onto specially fitted cradles. At his own suggestion, Nahut rode in the back of the truck, which would take just over 30 hours to cover the long and arduous journey to Addis Ababa. The Pegasus Falcon was standing on the airport tarmac when the dusty truck trundled out through the security gates and parked beside it. Von Schiller and Jutta Kemper had made the journey in the company helicopter. General Obaid was with them. He had come to wish them au revoir and Godspeed. While the wooden crates were loaded into the jet, Obaid spoke to the waiting customs officer. He stamped the documents, clearing the 2 cases of geological samples for export, and then discreetly retired. "Loaded and ready to start engines, Herr von Schiller," said the uniformed Pegasus chief pilot, saluting. Von Schiller shook hands with Obaid and clambered up the boarding ladder. Jutta and Nahut Gaudabi followed him. The rings under Nahut's eyes were even darker and deeper than usual. The journey had come close to exhausting him entirely, but he would not let the wooden cases out of his sight. The Falcon climbed up into a bright, clear sky over the mountains and headed northwards. A few moments after the pilot extinguished the seatbelt panel, Jutta Kemper thrust her lovely blonde head through the cockpit door and asked the chief pilot, "Herr von Schiller would like to know our ETA. I expect to touch down at Frankfurt at 2100 hours. Please inform Herr von Schiller that I have already radioed a head office to give instructions for transport to be awaiting our arrival at the airport."